those who are listening that would like to engage with us that are not listening live, particularly those of you who listen to the archives of this program, Scott has created a Facebook page for you to interact. It does include the most recent stories and features and things that we are pursuing on the program. The Facebook site is quite simply facebook.com/shatteringmyths. We'd encourage you to participate there and engage with us. Also, as a program note, this evening at 7:30 Eastern Standard Time, 4:30 Pacific, actually it's daylight time, we will be conducting our Shabbat program. We're continuing to review what Dod, who is known as David, wrote in the most important of all Psalms, a song devoted to properly observing the Torah. And we will continue our review of what he wrote. I would like to pick up what Paul wrote because it is essential, particularly in English-speaking countries, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, as well as the realization that English is the primary second language amongst most people around the world. That we, in recognition of the fact that the most popular religion in the world continues to be Christianity, that we continue to question Paul, that we continue to consider and then examine closely and then criticize, ultimately condemning what he wrote. Paul was not the most repulsive man who ever lived. Muhammad was. And there are some people that whose behavior was even more repulsive than Paul's. Hadrian, the emperor of Rome, for example. Caligula, another Roman emperor, would be examples of absolutely reprehensible men. But Paul is the most infamous man in the world. Paul's letters had a greater influence on the world than did anyone else who has ever lived. There is no more influential individual in the history of humankind than Paul. And it pains Yahweh enormously. Yahweh calls him the plague of death and asks us prophetically, 666 years before Paul wrote his first letter, Yahweh, through the prophet Habakkuk, says, "Why don't you question him?" Described Paul by every one of his attributes, by his mission, by his audience, by his timing, and by name. Exposing and condemning him. And so we're going to do what God encouraged us to do. We're going to continue to evaluate and question what he wrote, holding him accountable. And the reason is clear. While we recognize that very few people will opt for the truth, will embrace the truth, will use evidence and reason by observing Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms to engage in the covenant and therefore be part of Yahweh's family and spend eternity with him, that number will continue to be very few. But for that number to grow from where it presently is, it is essential that we expose and condemn Christianity. Because before anyone's going to participate in the covenant, they are first going to have to walk away from that religion. There are no Christians in heaven. There are no Christians as part of God's family. If you're a Christian, you are absolutely excluded. So it's important that we share with you the reasons that you should disassociate yourself with Christianity so that you at least have the opportunity to act upon the terms and conditions of the covenant to become part of God's family. Paul wrote in Galatians 1:13, "For because indeed you heard of my wayward behavior in some time and place in the practice of Judaism, namely, that because throughout showing superiority, surpassing any measure of restraint, to an extraordinary degree and better than anyone else, I was aggressively and intensely pursuing, hastily striving towards, persecuting, oppressing, and harassing the called out of God. And I was and am devastating her, continuing to undermine, overthrow, and annihilate her. And so I was and continue to progress, accomplishing a great deal in the practice of Judaism, beyond many contemporaries among my race, excessively enthusiastic to belong to the traditions and teachings handed down by my forefathers. Paul, in the first statement, said that he was a murderer. In the first statement, he blamed Judaism for making him a murderer. That's, Judaism's wrong for a lot of reasons, but that's not one of them. Paul lied in that. He was a murderer because of the fact that he was a perverted, demon-possessed, and insane man. His ego, his internal rage caused him to be a murderer, not Judaism. In the second, Paul says that he was an extraordinarily devout and accomplished a great deal in the practice of Judaism. That also is a lie. There were Jewish scholars during this time whose words and deeds are chronicled for us to read in the Jerusalem Talmud. And there are two Talmuds, the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud being the dominant of the two, but the Babylonian Talmud wasn't written until 500 CE, and the Jerusalem Talmud was written, compiled between about 200 BCE and about 200 CE. And so it is this Jerusalem Talmud that the history of those who were considered scholars, those who were considered effective proponents of Judaism, their words and their deeds are chronicled. Guess who's not mentioned? Paul. Paul absolutely was not an accomplished practitioner of Judaism. It's an absolute lie. Another one by Paul. Now, what is true is that Judaism is an enthusiastic embrace of the traditions handed down by Jewish forefathers. There is a grotesque misconception promoted by Christians, and particularly Roman Catholics, that the Torah is part of Judaism, that Yahweh's invitations to meet with him, the seven of them each year, beginning with Pesach, ending with Sukkah, are Jewish holidays. That is just not true. Judaism is a religion comprised by human traditions. It embraces rabbinical arguments today. The arguments of the oral law take precedent. It's the Talmud, it's the Mishnah that provide the traditions, the rules, the laws by which religious Jews live. Now, it's interesting that there's so many misconceptions about being Jewish. Today, the majority of Jews are not religious. In fact, a very substantial majority of Jews are not religious. They're mostly secular. They're mostly agnostics. Some are atheists. But very few are religious. Even in Israel, it's only about 20% of Jews in Israel that are Orthodox practitioners of Judaism. Most Jews are not religious. And be Jewish is a race. Judaism is a religion. They are not coterminous. Now, it's true that the vast preponderance of the practitioners of Judaism are racially Jewish. But it's not true that the preponderance of those who are racially Jewish practice Judaism. And so those are misconceptions. But the greatest misconception of all is this association with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms with Judaism. When you read the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, what you find is that God consistently repudiates the Jewish religion. Every form of the Jewish religion, God repudiates. He says that he had to divorce himself of Yisrael because of the Jewish religion, that he's appalled by the Jewish religion, that he calls all aspects of the Jewish religion an abomination. Yahweh hates Judaism with a passion. And Yahweh makes it very clear that the Torah is his gift to the world. It's one Torah for everyone. He says so emphatically. He also says that the invitations to meet, these seven steps that we take to enter his home, are for everyone. He tells us the covenant is for everyone. These things are not things only for Jews. And there is no association between them and Judaism. But here Paul, in the second half of his statement, has made a correct statement that Judaism is based on the traditions of the Jewish forefathers. It is not based on the Torah. And he made that distinction, and he's correct in that regard. But it's a point typically missed, because the first half of his statement is a outright lie, that he was a superior advocate of Judaism. He wasn't. Not even remotely. He wouldn't even be in the top. Oh, I was going to say top 10%, but no, not even the top 50%. He would have been considered by rabbinical apologists, by rabbinical advocates, as a gargantuan liability to the religion, not an advocate, not a proponent. He was an adversary. And as such, Paul's statement is another just outright lie. Now we'll return to this evaluation in a moment. As I mentioned yesterday, by successively, one time after another, deploying the imperfect tense with these verbs, Paul has left no doubt that his unrestrained and depraved behavior and his participation in the very religion that Yahweh and Yahusha condemned were not limited to past experiences, but both were ongoing in devotion and fascination. He was and would continue to be a religiously inspired assassin. And indeed, Paul morphed many of the worst characteristics of Judaism into Christianity, thereby spreading its devastating consequences from a few to many, from Yehudim to Goyim. Now, this confession means that there was no conversion experience on the road to Damascus. Now, while I'm saying that Paul's assessment of his status within Judaism is completely fraudulent, I'm not questioning whether or not Paul was religious and that he embraced Judaism. I'll take him at his word. I'm just saying that his boast that he was a spectacular Jew in the practice of the Jewish religion, that boast is fraudulent. But it means, folks, because this letter was penned years after, it's the first letter that was penned after his alleged conversion experience, that since he was trained as a Jewish rabbi, and it says right now that I was and I continue to be a practitioner of Judaism, and not just any. I'm superior. I'm better than any of my compatriots. This is a boast that he will affirm again through Luke and the book of Acts. Under that basis, folks, just like there was no conversion experience with Constantine, there's no conversion experience with Paul. Nothing changed. He did not progress from attacking God's covenant children to nurturing them, from rabbinical traditions to the Christian religion. If, as Yahweh asserts, it was Satan, under the guise and moniker of the Lord, who had influenced the Israelites to oppose his Torah and to reject his covenant in favor of their oral traditions, then, as Shaul will later admit, it was the same spirit who appeared to the founder of the Christian religion on the road to Damascus. In his opposition to God, Paul would display the same attitude and the same approach now manifest throughout the Talmud. And he was just like the authors of Jewish traditions, who, while claiming to speak for God, did the opposite. Likewise, and in the manner of the rabbis, Shaul's characterization of the Messiah would bear no resemblance to most of the promises made about him in the Torah of the prophets. The Christian Christ, like the rabbinic Messiah, were both estranged from Yahweh. And the most penalizing of all, there would be no connection between the Messiah and his fulfillment of the Mikra, either in the Talmud or in Paul's letters. Also, as was the case with the rabbis, Paul would deploy arguments which made his testimony, at least in the eyes of his adherents, more relevant than and even vastly superior to God's. To this day, religious Jews hold their Talmud over the Torah, just as every religious Christian values their New Testament, comprised chiefly of Paul's letters, over the Word of God, especially over his Torah. Nothing has changed here except the audience. In these words, Paul has conveyed and indeed embraced the rabbinical mindset, defining what it means to be an adherent of Judaism. The religion was conceived to zealously incorporate and integrate every descendant of Jacob so that each and every religious Jew would have their lives defined and governed by these oral traditions. Christianity has had a very similar influence on Gentiles with nations, communities, and cultures for vast swaths of time, often being indistinguishable from the religion. It was the Holy Roman Empire, the Roman Catholic Church. Politics and religion became one, and for enormous periods of time. All because of what Paul has done and would do with his poison pen. We'll be back and consider more of what Paul had to say after the break. We shouldn't be surprised that the Greek word designating religious teaching and traditions in Paul's letters, and those would be the teachings and traditions of the elders, with basis of Judaism, was paradosis. It also means to surrender, to give up, to deliver oneself into the hands of others. It's used, it's based on the verbal root, whose tertiary definition after surrender and to be delivered into custody is to be judged, to be condemned, to be punished, to be put to death, and to be anguished as a result of treachery. The fourth connotation conveys to be taught in such a way as to be molded as the result of verbal reports. This could be said of Islam too, I guess. In the realm of etymology, this is especially revealing because it espouses the cause and the consequence of religious traditions. Therefore, so is Paul. He loved his religion. He hated his people. They would not honor him the way the Gentiles have now done. With regard to Paul's affinity for Judaism, please consider this confession. Having climbed some stairs to rise above his audience, motioning for them to be silenced, and then speaking in Hebrew, Paul proclaimed, "Men, brothers and fathers, you must listen to me to this regarding and against you, the current and present defense and justification. Even God does not say you must listen to me. He encourages us hundreds of times to listen to him. But it's always under the auspices of free will. It's our choice. He's shared his teaching, his instruction, his direction, his Torah with us in hopes that we will observe what he has to say, that we will read it and recite it, his words, so that we can listen to him. That's his hope. But he never says must. And in this particular occasion, Paul used the Greek word aku. Well, actually, he was speaking Hebrew, but he himself translated his Hebrew into Greek. Mau, which means, now I command you to hear me. This was written in the aorist active imperative. I command you. You must. Listen. To his current and present defense and justification. Now, as is the case throughout Paul's letters, he is defending and justifying his credentials and his message. Not Yahweh's, not Yahusha's. He didn't say, you must listen to God. He didn't even say you should listen to God. He most certainly didn't say you should listen to Yahweh or Yahusha. He most certainly didn't quote Yahweh or Yahusha, at least not accurately. He's not saying, it's really in your interest to listen to God. I mean, that's what I'm telling you. It's in your interest to listen to God. That, by the way, is that the 119th Psalm that we're going to consider this evening on Blog Talk Radio and Yada Yah Radio on the Shabbat Torah study. What we're going to do is consider the way, the manner in which the man that Yahweh loved more than any other who has ever lived, though, to David, observed the Torah, how he chose to listen to God, what he listened to, what was important, how he what did he prioritize in the Torah? What did he learn from the Torah? How did he respond to the Torah? And what he encourages us to do is to listen to what God has to say in his Torah direction, his Torah guidance. Well, my encouragement to you is listen to what Yahweh has to say in his Torah. That wasn't what Paul said. He says, you must listen to me. To my justification. To my defense. I don't defend myself. You want to attack me? Have at it. Back in the days that I was promoting Prophet of Doom, there were hundreds of thousands of articles and sites condemning me. I never visited any of them. You could Google my name at the time, and it would, say 900,000 links. And never went there. Never read any of them. Didn't care. It was an absolute waste of time for me to defend myself. I never even got defensive. Don't care what you have to say about me. Paul cared about what they had to say about him. He cared about defending himself. I don't care about defending myself. I got nothing to sell you. I've got nothing to convince you of. I am happy to share with you what Yahweh said. I'm happy to expose and condemn those who lied about God. But my opinion, worthless. I'm not going to ever defend myself. It's an absolute, total and complete waste of time. But not to Paul. I love Yahweh's words. He hated them. Paul loved his own words. I hate them. the difference. It's a broken record, figuratively and literally. Rather than encouraging us to listen to God, Paul is demanding that we listen to him. Then what did he say previously? You know, if anybody preaches to you a different message, they should be eternally condemned than what he was preaching, right? Eternally condemned. Then rather than tell the uplifting story of Yahweh, the story of Yahusha, our troubled troubadour continued to tout Paul from Tarsus. And then, having heard that the Hebrew language he had been and was continuing to use to address them, the more they continued to be quiet. And he declares, now, this is Acts 22:2. It serves as one of many indications that the conversations that are now recorded in Greek throughout the so-called Christian New Testament were originally spoken in Hebrew. Hebrew is the language of Yahweh. Hebrew is the language of heaven. Hebrew is the language of revelation. Yahusha spoke Hebrew. If you don't know Hebrew, if you can't think in Hebrew, if you don't understand the uniqueness of the Hebrew vocabulary and grammar, then you are not in a position where you can understand who Yahweh is and what he's offering. I'm here to tell you that I have no issue with translation. I have no issue with you translating the Hebrew into English and thinking in English, so long as you recognize the uniqueness of Hebrew and that you acknowledge that Yahusha spoke Hebrew, that the Torah is written in Hebrew, and that everything God had to say, everything that he revealed, is taught to us in Hebrew. And as such, that you acknowledge that there's something special about that language that helps us understand who God is and what he's offering. Now, if you go there and you realize that to understand God, you have to understand Hebrew. You've got to look at and examine the Hebrew vocabulary he used and the uniqueness of the Hebrew stems, conjugations, and moods. Now, if you do that, and you're serious about it, then you can absolutely translate these thoughts into English. But you have to start at the Hebrew. And if you don't, you're just kidding yourself. You're wasting your time. You're pretending. Even with Shaul's poison pen, there are some insights that are conveyed that are important for you to acknowledge, particularly if you are a Christian, particularly if, as a Christian, you are open to questioning your religion and its veracity. And one of those is that all of God's communication to us, all of it, without exception, is in Hebrew. And you'll either learn to speak and understand Hebrew, or you will never be able to communicate with God. In heaven, we're going to be speaking Hebrew. In the covenant family, we will be speaking Hebrew. The Torah, Yahweh's teaching that he's going to place inside of us, the guidance that he says that he himself is going to incorporate into our very nature, is in Hebrew. Don't fight it. Fighting Hebrew is like pushing away God. Yahweh is manifest in the words that he conveyed to us in Hebrew. Yahusha is the Hebrew words of the Torah alive on this planet. Now, we've talked a lot about Hebrew, and this is a Greek text here, translating to Greek, but I am going to share with you a couple of things that are important for you to recognize. That God equates himself with light. He says, I am light. On light, time simply exists. The past, the present, and future all exist simultaneously. On a photon of light, you could travel all of the breadth of time, all of the breadth of the distance of the universe in no time at all. You could enjoy the past and the future simultaneously. That's the nature of light. But Yahweh's chosen language is exactly the same. In Hebrew, there is no past, present, or future tense. Everything is eternally true. Think about that. Now, in Hebrew, virtually every verb, every actional event is relational. They have stems. And the stems establish the relationship between the speaker and the object, typically between God and ourselves. And in Hebrew, there are moods. And virtually every Hebrew mood expresses desire and volition. God wants to convey everything to us under the auspices of free will. All of this reference to Hebrew, and that Hebrew was the language that was spoken in Yisrael, tells us how important it is to realize that 100% of what Yahusha said, 100% of what Yahweh has revealed to us in Hebrew. Now, there is a tiny, 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 I mean, one fraction of 1% of what he's revealed that was in Aramaic. And I'll acknowledge that. There's one statement and attributed to him in the Christian New Testament that is in Aramaic. So everything he said is in Hebrew. There's one tiny statement that may be in Aramaic. And in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, everything is written in Hebrew except about one-fifth of one book, and that would be Daniel, and it was written in Aramaic. Now, that means that it's somewhere a tiny fraction of 1% of what Yahweh inspired was inspired in Aramaic, in addition to the 99.9% that was inspired in Hebrew. But I do want you to keep in mind this, that if you translate, which I have done fairly recently even, the Aramaic portions of Daniel, as it goes from Hebrew to Aramaic back to Hebrew again, that the vocabulary is almost identical. And if you can read Hebrew, you can read Aramaic. And little minor differences in some of the grammar rules. But vocabulary, essentially the same. Now, when we think of this admonition that Paul, to ingratiate himself with Hebrew, spoke Hebrew, it is, as I say, an affirmation that we should apply the Hebrew names to these characters, not Greek names. So it's not the Torah cannot have a book named Genesis. It can have a book named Bereshith. It can't have a book named Exodus. It can have a book named Shemoth, which means names. It can't have a book named Leviticus, even though Leviticus aspires to be a transliteration of one of the characters described in the book, because there's no V in Hebrew. So it could be Loi, but it isn't Loi. The first word in the book, which defines the title of the book, is Kara. It means to call out, to be invited, to meet, to read, to recite. We can't have a book of Deuteronomy, which means Second Law. But we can have a book called Devarim, which means words. We can't have a Jesus, but we can have a Yahusha. We can't have an Isaiah, but we can have a Yeshayah. We can't have a Jeremiah, but we can have a Yirmiyahu. We can't have a Christ, but we can have a Masayah. We can't have a Lord unless that Lord is Satan, but we can have Yahweh. There are so many things that this revelation in Hebrew opens up. And then once we know that all of the names are Hebrew and all of the words are Hebrew, then we can look at the Hebrew names and learn something from them. Like Maaseyah means the work of Yahweh. Yahusha means Yahweh saves. Yirmiyah, Yahweh uplifts. Zachariah means remember Yah. All of the names now have meaning. Even a name that doesn't have Yahweh's name in it, like Moshe, has meaning because he was chosen by Yahweh to lead his people away from Mitzrayim, which is the crucible of religious and political and military and economic oppression. It means to draw out. Every name. A name like Noah means trustworthy guide. Every name now provides meaning, insight. Now, especially Yahweh's name. Yahweh's name. Two individuals standing up. The mother and the father of the covenant, Abraham and Sarah. The last one even being feminine. Reaching up, looking up to Yahweh's outstretched and open hand. The Father. Willing to lift up those who look up to him. Who care about what he had to say. Who listen to him. It's a very powerful message that so many miss. We'll talk to you on Monday.